interrogates the interrogator. In the full moon of the flashlight, every face is the face of Guillermo.
Thank you, Martina Spotter. We are out of time. Stay tuned for more.
En fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie, et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi, éperdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule, et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux.
Entraînés You're listening par to KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO for Bridge Over Troubled Water. A tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 18th from noon to 5:30 p.m. This retrospective program honors Dr. King's work through a combination of archives, audio, and contemporary interviews featuring artists, activists, public officials, and community members who have participated in this event over the years. Bridge Over Troubled Waters draws inspiration from Dr. King's mission to ensure peace, social justice, civil rights, and human dignity for all. Again, that's Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King on Monday, January the 18th from noon to 5:30 p.m. here on Community Radio, KBOO.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Neil Sheehan, who died on January 7, 2021, at the age of 84, was one of the great American journalists. Known for having broken the Pentagon Papers in the New York Times, he was also the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winning author of A Bright Shining Lie, a history of the American involvement in Vietnam, as told through the life of Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann. I had the opportunity to interview Neil Sheehan while he was on tour for his book A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Shriver and the Ultimate Weapon.
This latest book is a history of the Cold War, now that it's over, told from the perspective of one individual, a man named Bernard Benny Shriver. And I understand that you were planning to write, you wanted to write a history of the Cold War, but you didn't have anything to grab onto until you found out that this man was living near you.
I was searching for a book. I'd written myself out on Vietnam, and someone said to me, why don't you write a book on the arms race in the Cold War? That's really a pretty diffuse topic. I like to write a narrative history that brings things alive for the reader. So I was over at the Air Force Association Library across the river from Washington in Arlington, and they keep files on major figures in the Air Force. And somebody told me, you ought to look up Bernard Shriver. His nickname was Benny because he was a great golfer when he was as a youth, and the reporters in San Antonio wanted something slicker in their headlines than Bernard, so they nicknamed him Benny. So I asked for his record, and the librarian gave it to me, and I opened it up. And the first thing in there was a photograph, which is in the book, of this handsome Air Force general sitting on the edge of a table, surrounded by all these models of all these missiles he'd built. And I said, he looks interesting. So I looked him up in the phone book, and he turned out to be living 8 blocks away from me. And I called him up. He said, come on over on Saturday morning. I went over, and that was the first of 52 interviews.
That particular interview, as you were starting it, were you thinking, this is the man? Or at what point did you realize that this was not merely the man, but this was, in a way, the book?
This didn't become apparent immediately. It was a number of interviews later. I realized that this man had stood at the center of the Cold War in a period which had been really never written about carefully before and hadn't been studied carefully before. People think of the Cold War as one long ice age, but it wasn't. In the 50s and at the turn of the 60s, it was quite a warm confrontation between the two superpowers. If something had gone wrong, we might well have had nuclear war. And I realized that this man and the work he'd done was at the center of that, of the Cold War, when it wasn't cold. And that if I told his story, I could chronicle that period of time in an exciting way. And I like to think, I hope at least, I cast light where there's darkness with a book. Well, this is a chance to cast some light.
The career of General Schriever is the career that pretty much takes him from World War II to running the ICBM program in the United States, which led to NASA, led to, as it turns out, I didn't know this, wide-bodied jets. The idea of choosing a general rather than a politician, what do you think that gave you, and how did that change your own perception of looking at the Cold War?
Military men are men of action, first of all, and I've written about the military all my life. I'd never written about this side of the military because I hadn't had an opportunity before. Military men, there's a decisiveness to their lives. There's an excitement to their lives. They're dealing with the most important thing ever. For instance, in Schriever's case, you and I might well not be having this conversation now had it not been for Schriever and his comrades and the accomplishments they made, because they staved off a nuclear holocaust during the first part of the Cold War. We might be little piles of irradiated dust. So I began to realize this as I talked further to this man. The Vietnam book was written about a military man, too, John Vann, who'd served 10 years in Vietnam before he was killed there. And Schriever, to me, could be used the same way. He was a lens through which I could look at this period of the Cold War, which was really a dangerous period.
The stunning part of it is the idea that creating so many ICBM missiles that we could destroy the Soviet Union several times over, and they're creating just enough to destroy us several times over, created a stalemate that ensured no hot war. Obviously, people like General LeMay and others didn't see it that way, and if they had been in charge, kaboom. From the beginning, do you think Schriever knew that this was the only way to stave off war by almost like overdoing it?
It seems like a contradiction in terms,
right?
Because it's difficult at first to deal with it. But yes, Schriever realized that the situation was inherently unstable and that you had to do something to stabilize it. He'd say over and over again, this is a weapon that's being built not to be used in war, but to deter war. It's the first in the history of humankind. We were dependent at the time for the United States nuclear deterrent on the bomber, the B-47s and the B-52s in the Strategic Air Command under the command of General Curtis LeMay, who'd been a great bomber leader in World War II and who then went off the rails during the Cold War. He was the inspiration for General Jack D. Ripper in Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, the grim-faced man with a cigar, etc. If you watch late-night television and you see a film called 12 O'Clock High on the bombing of Germany, it shows you the experience LeMay had. They had enormous casualties, having fighting their way deep into Germany, but the bombers always got through in his mind. So he believed in nothing else. Unfortunately, and Schriever could see this, LeMay's bombers were about to be undercut. The credibility of them was about to be undercut by technology. It was possible to build an intercontinental ballistic missile which would arrive within 15 minutes. That's all the warning you'd have. And you'd have no way of stopping the thing. So you wouldn't be able to get the planes off the ground in time. Now, you could take things like HEVSIM, some of them on airborne alert, but you couldn't put the whole force in that. And in any case, once a weapon like this existed in large numbers, the credibility of the deterrent would be undercut, and then you'd get, Schriever was convinced, more instability, and you'd get a possible adventurism by Soviet leaders that would trigger a nuclear war.
It also created a situation where, had the Soviets not countered, there could just have easily been adventurism on the part of people like Curtis LeMay who would have said, screw it, let's just bomb Russia.
He wasn't that bad. There are people who said, yeah, let's bomb Russia. They were so-called preventive war people. We're going to have to fight them anyway, so let's drop the bomb now. LeMay believed in preemptive war. That is, if he was convinced that the Russians were going to attack us, then we should strike the first blow. The problem was that he didn't realize that these weapons of his were suicidal weapons, that the ecological side effects of nuclear weapons were such that they would destroy life in the Northern Hemisphere. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, Curtis LeMay, if they turned him loose and told him to do it, was going to drop 2,400 megatons of thermonuclear explosive on the Soviet Union. That's the equivalent of 192,000 Hiroshima bombs. The ecological side effects would have, there would have been no agriculture because all that dirt thrown up into the atmosphere would have blocked out the sun. All the water sources would have been poisoned permanently for tens of God knows how many thousands of years. Every time it rained, more people would have died of radiation poisoning. It would be the end of the Northern Hemisphere. But he did not understand that. He wasn't planning to actually disobey the president. But during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we came very close because Nikita Khrushchev put the missiles in Cuba to try to overcome the American strategic advantage. And when we found out that they were there, the military unanimously, not just LeMay, wanted to attack the missile sites and knock out the missiles. What they didn't know was that the Soviets already had nuclear warheads for those missiles in Cuba. And the missiles could reach as far as New York. They were practicing at night. And this is something you don't find out till the war is over. And the Cold War is over, so we now know this. They were practicing loading these missiles, the warheads, nuclear warheads, on the missiles at night when the reconnaissance planes wouldn't catch them at it, and then hiding them during the day. If the United States military had attacked and those Soviet missile crews were under fire, they probably would have launched a missile. In fact, one guy who was a retired general, senior general, he was head of the Strategic Rocket Forces. He was a lieutenant on one of those batteries. He said, yes, we would have fired one of the missiles if we were attacked. Those things could reach as far as New York. Now, at that point, you got people like LeMay who would have just gone. If one nuclear warhead hit one American city, LeMay would not have waited for the president. He would have just said, go.
Neil Sheehan, did Schriever, did he sense this idea of nuclear winter?
When I talked to him, he was conscious of all these things. He said to me once that Chernobyl was a small thing in nuclear effects. It was just a small example of what could happen. No, he was quite conscious of it. He knew what he was talking about. He was a thoughtful man. He wasn't dealing just with weapons. He was dealing with strategic effects of weapons and the political outcome that would result.
One subtext through all of this is the way the military-industrial complex came together. At one point, the military is working with these companies, and then at the next point, Schriever hits a brick wall with this, where the companies are starting to control what's happening rather than America's needs, say.
The problem he ran into was that we did not have an aerospace industry in this country. We just had an aircraft industry. He had to create an aerospace industry to build these missiles, because you're talking about, you know, what is an ICBM? It's a rocket with a warhead that has a hydrogen bomb in it. It's fired up into space. It travels across 6,000 to 7,000 miles at 16,000 miles an hour, and then it comes down on its target. There were a lot of problems to be solved, and we didn't have an industry capable of doing that. The aircraft industry had gotten fat, building aircraft during World War II at a clip pace. And they had friends in high places, and they tried to block him. They wanted control over the program in order to profit and milk it. And he was determined not to give them the control because they wouldn't make it succeed. They didn't know what they were doing. And it was quite a fight he put up, and he finally won it. An outfit called Convair was really out to get him. They were trying to get him fired or pressure him into giving them the program. But there was a military-industrial complex. It wasn't really as simple as people think it is. What you got was you got an industry which was dependent upon military orders. Then they get friends within the military, and they try to influence things. But it wasn't a simple thing. In case of Schriever, he was battling them.
When Schriever finally began to move on, which was the start of the American space program, it was also the era when Vietnam began to take over. Someone like Schriever, what would he think about Vietnam? I mean, we know that And again, it's in the book, but it's also in Bright Shining Light, exactly where things went sour, decisions made. As he saw it from the outside, did he talk at all about Vietnam?
I talked to him to some extent about Vietnam. He really didn't understand what had happened there. He retired from the military in 66, but earlier on, he was not involved in any of the Vietnam programs. And the big work that he'd done was in the 50s and the turn of the 60s. What's ironic about that whole thing is that technology was something we could make work, which Schriever and his cohorts did. They created a nuclear stalemate, which bought time for the Soviet Union to collapse.
Which brings up something else. It's considered conventional wisdom among the media, the corporate media, that the Soviet Union collapsed because Reagan forced them into debt over military arms. And what you suggest here is that's not it at all. The Soviet Union was rotting from within anyway.
It certainly was rotting from within. I mean, the Soviet Union was an unworkable society. And we're talking about Stalin's state, as I get into in the book, because I reach out to the wider stage of the Cold War. You know, why did it start? The three pillars of the state were, one, the KGB, before that the NKVD, as it was called. It was the main pillar, the secret police. Then you had the military, and then you had the party. None of these three organizations produced anything that could be sold. They simply took. We don't have precise figures. They're impossible to get. But as far as one can figure out, the military were getting about 25 to 30% of all production in Russia. It had missiles, but no pharmaceutical industry worth a damn. It was a narrowly based economy. The rot set in pretty early. Khrushchev was the last reformer. He liberalized within and he tried to reform. Afterwards, Leonid Brezhnev, who succeeded him, overthrowing him in 64, he was a status quo figure. The economy started to decline, in fact, under Brezhnev. Brezhnev was interested in his mistresses and wild boar shooting that he took Henry Kissinger out on. He was interested, you know, running this great big state, the Soviet Union. He certainly didn't want any nuclear wars. He didn't want anybody spoiling his pleasant life. I quote Brezhnev in the book as saying to his brother at one point, communism is just something to tell the population. And Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, attempted to reform. When you try to reform a system like that, you tend to make it worse. And it came down.
You're listening to an interview with Neil Sheehan, who died on January 7, 2021, at the age of 84, recorded on October 12, 2009, while he was on tour for his book, A Fiery Peace in a Cold War. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.
You present the idea that the Cold War got hotter because the U.S. misunderstood Stalin's blockade of Berlin, and Stalin, thinking that the U.S. was out to get him, obviously responded in kind. If the U.S. could have gotten Stalin, wouldn't they have?
I don't think so. Going to war with the Soviet Union was something that, after World War II, I don't think anybody, I mean, people wanted to avoid that sort of thing. We didn't want to get involved in another major war. Stalin was constantly shooting himself in the foot. He was a paranoid monster, the second greatest monster of the 20th century. He suffered almost from clinical paranoia. He trusted no one. Shortly before the war with Germany, 37, 38, in the Great Terror, he shot the whole high command of the Red Army, rendered it leaderless at a time when he might be invaded by Hitler, and was subsequently. And one of the reasons for the major defeats in the beginning was because Stalin had wiped out the whole damn high command, all the people with experience. In the case of Berlin, he shot himself in the foot because we were unifying the western parts of Germany, the three allies. He wanted to prevent that. He thought that Luftwaffe had not been able to supply the Germans at Stalingrad, the great turning point battle of World War II. Stalin said, well, if the Luftwaffe couldn't supply an army of 250,000 men, how are the Americans going to supply a whole city? They'll have to give in and negotiate to keep Germany dismembered on my terms. Well, he didn't realize. He had no conception of the transport capabilities the American Air Force could marshal. So the whole thing turned into a fiasco. I mean, it was a wonderful propaganda thing for the United States, because here are these films of these planes coming in through the snow and the rain and the children waving at them. It was incredible. What had happened was, after the war, you had, of course, the French, British, and American and Soviet zones. They were supposed to be governed under a four-power council. The economy was getting worse and worse and worse. And also, remember, the Cold War was getting worse as we collided with Stalin in other areas, over Eastern Europe, etc., Stalin's repressive policies there. the Americans and the other allies wanted to resurrect the German economy. You couldn't do that if the country was constantly fragmented. So they wanted to unify their sections and resurrect the economy. Stalin didn't want that. He wanted Germany kept fragmented, and he wanted reparations on a large scale, which he wasn't given. And so he assumed, well, I'll blockade the Americans in Berlin, and then they'll have to negotiate with me because they won't be able to feed the city. We were able to feed the city, and then he was desperate to lift the blockade.
Khrushchev's putting missiles in Cuba was kind of a tit-for-tat for the United States putting missiles in Turkey, and that backfired as well.
Khrushchev acted to some extent because we put missiles in Turkey. I don't think the United States was thinking clearly when it did that, because it was something of a provocation. Also, the Russians were not making the progress they were supposed to be making in building ICBMs. Shriver and his people were outdistancing them. There was a missile gap, but the missile gap was on the Soviet side. So Khrushchev was trying to even the score by putting these missiles, 90 miles off the shore, etc. It turned out, we now know, within reach of New York. It backfired because he was warned by Gromyko and others that, first of all, the Americans are going to catch you doing this. You're not going to be able to hide them. And secondly, you don't understand. The Americans view Cuba with great sensitivity. If you put missiles in Cuba, there'll be a political explosion in the United States, and the Americans will have to do something about it. This Russian garrison with these missiles was thousands of miles away from the Soviet Union. How are they going to support them? Khrushchev was warned by a number of his contemporaries, look, this is crazy. Don't do it. He was a curious man. He was an internal liberalizer and a foreign adventurer. And he just pressed ahead, and the whole thing blew up in his face.
Neil Sheehan, in writing this book, what did you specifically learn? Were there any real revelations that you learned on the way that just were aha moments, where pieces came together in ways you hadn't suspected?
We Americans always like to think that the Normandy landing was a decisive battle of World War II, because we're so cultural-centric, if I can make up a term. It wasn't. It was an important battle, the Normandy landing, but it was a finishing battle. The turning point battle of World War II was Stalingrad, a year and a half earlier and 2,000 miles away, further to the east. We did not defeat the Germans in World War II in Europe. The Russians defeated them. And also, the fact that Stalin, the monster he was, became more and more clear as I got into the research. Decapitating your army before your enemy's going to invade. The chief of the German general staff, a man named Halder, wrote in his diary, "Die Rote Armee ist führerlos." This is on the eve of the German invasion of Russia in 1941. It's German for, it may be ungrammatical, my pronunciation of it, but the Red Army is leaderless. And it was. That, to me, was a revelation.
Neil Sheehan, you were the guy who Daniel Ellsberg went to with the Pentagon Papers, which was, 7,000-page history of Vietnam that was commissioned 2 years earlier by Robert McNamara. Do you think a Pentagon Papers event could happen today? And if not, why not?
I think things like the Pentagon Papers are brought on by long, terrible wars. And Vietnam was a catastrophe that went on for years, that divided the country more than any time since the Civil War. And then you had a man who was full of guilt, Robert McNamara, in 1967, who commissions this study, which ended up being a secret archive of the war itself. I'm talking about the internal telegrams, the orders, the memoranda, etc. That's an extraordinary thing. And it only happens on rare occasions. We've learned a lot about Bush going into Iraq, but nothing as explosive as the Pentagon Papers.
Well, we seem to know about the lies pretty early on when it comes to Iraq.
Yes, but in the case of the Pentagon Papers, and I covered Vietnam for 3 years in Vietnam and then in Washington, so altogether for 10 years, it amazed me how much they've been able to keep hidden then. Now, how much Bush has been able to hide, I don't know. But I don't think a lot, because it's a defeat. I suspect it's not a lot anyway. We can see the disaster.
When you look back on your time in Vietnam, is there a certain feeling of excitement that you felt you were in the right place at the right time to do the right thing?
Oh, there was a great excitement being a young reporter in Vietnam, yeah. I mean, because, first of all, it was an important story. You felt you were getting information out that otherwise would never get out. you were getting truths out that would never see the light of day. So that's a very powerful feeling for a journalist to have, that he's casting light in dark places. That's what you're supposed to do, get the truth out.
And when Ellsberg first contacted you about the Pentagon Papers, your eyes must have widened. I mean, did you believe that something like this could exist?
Well, that was a complicated story. I knew about it earlier, but when I started to read them, I was just amazed at how much they'd managed to hide.
It strikes me now in reading your book, A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Neil Sheehan, that there was always so much to hide. I mean, there are little bits and pieces in this book about the Cold War that we're still uncovering now.
That's true, although the most interesting stuff has come up from the Russian-Soviet side since the collapse of the Soviet Union. We now understand, you know, what Stalin's motive was behind the Berlin blockade, for instance. We know now that he didn't have a plan to conquer Western Europe. What he wanted to do was hold on to Eastern Europe that he'd gotten during World War II. We now know that the Korean War, for instance, was another miscalculation based upon Dean Acheson and a number of others saying we weren't interested in South Korea. And so Stalin allowed Kim Il-sung to talk him into arming Kim Il-sung and turning them loose. It was all posited on the assumption that the Americans would not intervene, because we said we wouldn't intervene.
Isn't that sort of like 1991 and Saddam Hussein thinking the Americans wouldn't intervene when he went into Kuwait?
That's right. Yeah, he made a major miscalculation too. Saddam Hussein, who is not the world's brightest man, should have realized you can't grab the Americans' gas station and not have them react.
Well, you were an early critic of the Bush invasion of Iraq. From the very beginning, I guess, you sensed this was something we shouldn't do. Was it just because of the experience of Vietnam, or was there more to it?
Vietnam influenced me a great deal, yeah. I mean, it was crazy. It made no sense at all. One of the reasons I think he did it was because he didn't experience Vietnam. He hid in the Texas Air National Guard, which his daddy got him in. Cheney got draft deferments. Rumsfeld wasn't involved in the war. Wolfowitz, who was Rumsfeld's deputy, was another one who escaped the war. Colin Powell got schnuckered by these intelligence reports. He was the only one who had any experience with Vietnam. I mean, if you'd come in to see me and said you wanted to go invade Iraq based upon my experience of Vietnam, I said, you're crazy. You're out of your mind, man. First of all, it's unnecessary. And that was one of the main lessons of the war in Vietnam. Don't start unnecessary wars, because after the first shot is fired, you don't know what the hell's going to happen. You know, when John Kennedy sent those advisors into Vietnam in 1961, a man named George Ball, who's the Undersecretary of State, said, Mr. President, if you send those advisors in helicopters, et cetera, into Vietnam, you're going to have 300,000 troops there in 5 years. And Kennedy said to Ball, George, you're crazier than hell. Ball said to me when I interviewed him, I was wrong. It was less than 5 years.
Neil Sheehan, we've got now, with Obama president, we've got two wars going on at once. I look at both of them, and I'm seeing two Vietnams, because in both cases, you know, there's no exit strategy, and people talk about winning, but nobody's defining winning.
They're going to get out of Iraq. The exit strategy is to get out of Iraq. I mean, we're starting to withdraw, and we're just going to leave. I hope nothing happens to the 50,000 men they plan to leave behind, but we're going to get out of that country. President Obama is simply going to get out. As far as Afghanistan is concerned, I hope they're careful, because that has the possibility of turning into a quagmire. No foreign army has ever lasted for a long time in Afghanistan. Its central government has always remained weak. It's a fragmented society. They don't think like us. Look at those mountains, man. The Russians went into Afghanistan in 1979. I remember when they went in, they allowed people to interview their troops at first before they kicked all of Western press out. And these young Russian kids were saying, listen, this is the Red Army. We defeated the Nazis. We'll take care of this. We'll fulfill our what they call our international duty. And I thought to myself, you poor beggars. I mean, because they sound like the American soldiers did in Vietnam in 65 in the beginning when they all believed. I thought, you know, 5 years from now, half of you will be dead or crippled and nobody will give a damn. And that's what happened. So one has to be very careful about a country like Afghanistan.
Neil Sheehan, in doing the research for A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, somewhere in the back of your mind, you must have been searching for the seeds of Vietnam to see whether they were there, how far they traced back. Did you find any seeds, anything that said, okay, I can see this is a piece in the puzzle from the 50s and 40s?
Yeah, about the fact that, you know, the Cold War bred an American theology about communism, which became real to not only to the leaders of this country. If you read Eisenhower's memoirs, he talks about the international communist conspiracy. He talks about the falling dominoes in Asia, which Truman first was concerned with, falling dominoes in the Middle East. We believed all that stuff. It was widely accepted by the American public, and it prevented us from understanding figures like Ho Chi Minh, who was a communist in his domestic politics, but who was essentially a nationalist. How destructive this Cold War theology became, because it was a theology. It didn't resemble reality at all.
You've been listening to an interview with Neil Sheehan, who died on January 7, 2021, at the age of 84, recorded on October 12, 2009, while he was on tour for his book, A Fiery Peace in a Cold War. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. The complete 40-minute interview can be heard as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org.
Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.